Good evening and welcome to Connection Q&A. We're live in the studio for an hour with Skip Heitzig, Senior Pastor at Calvary of Albuquerque. Skip is here to answer your questions about tonight's teaching. Call now, 505-338-5790, or call the toll-free number from outside the Albuquerque area, 1-866-730-4921. That's 866-730-4921. And now, Connection Q&A.
Hi, and welcome to the Connection Q&A with Pastor Skip Heitzig. I'm your host, Brian Nixon. If you have a question for Pastor Skip, we'd love to hear from you this evening. The number to call is 338-5790. That's 338-5790. If you're calling from out of the Albuquerque area, you can dial 1-866-730-4921. That's 1-866-730-4921. If you'd like to join us via the internet, you can go to connectionradio.org and follow the live icons and you'll see us live. Or you could always go to Ustreamer and you just have to type in Skip Live in the search and you could find us on Ustream TV as well. Those numbers once again though are 338-5790. That's 338-5790. Or out of the Albuquerque area, 1-866-730-4921. Internet is connectionradio.org. We would like to invite you to some of the upcoming events here at Calvary of Albuquerque. The Challenge Men's Ministry is presenting The Days of Noah, and this is a study preparing for Christ's return. And this begins on Saturday, January 17th at 8 a.m. in the Hub, and we do have a full February. If you would love to see Jim Caviezel, we invite you to join us on February 8th, where he'll be here speaking, showing the passion of the Christ, as well as have a time of question and answer. And then on February 13th, we have Potter's Field Ministry, Sweetness and Light. So some great things coming up at Calvary of Albuquerque, and Pastor Skip just walked in. Skip, welcome to Connection Q&A.
Brian Nixon, it's good to see you. Here's what I've noticed about tonight. You're wearing a brown zip-up. I'm wearing a brown zip-up. Great minds think alike.
But you know, Skip, looking at your brown zip-up, it is much more a dark brown. It's like a dark chocolate brown as opposed to my, well, just more plain brown.
Okay.
But you know, I mean, they're still brown though. They're still brown, and that I agree with you. And they're both zip-up brown sweaters. So those people who are joining us on Ustream or on connectionradio.org, they could see that. But those who are listening via the radio are unable to see the color differentiation.
Differentiation?
That's right. That's right. There is a color differentiation. And you know, Skip, Someone's joining us here in the studio. And again, for those who are on the radio, it's a mystery who this person is. But if they are joining us via the internet, they can see that there's a third mystery person.
It is fantastic. Yeah, we have a friend of mine named John Privett. And John was the worship leader at our church years ago. I'm talking 1980s, like 83, right around there, 82, 83, 84. And then he moved back to Nashville. They don't say Nashville, it's Nashville.
Nashville.
Back there, just like it's Asheville, North Carolina. And John is a pastor of a Calvary Chapel. He was also a country singer, songwriter, has done a lot of different projects on his own, joint projects with Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson. Really good stuff. So he's a pretty talented musician, as you are, Brian.
Well, Skip, but here's the thing about John.
Do you play country music, Brian Nixon?
I could play country music. It's something I usually don't do. But let me say.
Do you have boots?
I do have kind of boots.
I want to see them.
They're not like pointy boots, John. I know you can't. We don't have a microphone on you, so you're just going to have to really speak up here. But they're not pointy boots, Skip. They're square-toed. So they're kind of in between a biker boot and a cowboy boot.
You in a biker boot or a cowboy boot? I got to see it.
Okay.
It's worth seeing.
One day, my friend.
I am not a cowboy.
You are not.
I'm kind of a biker because I ride motorcycles, but I'll wear boots on those occasions from time to time. I'll indulge.
I've seen you wear your what I would call biker boots, and they are square-toed.
Kind of cool.
They are kind of cool. They're kind of cool. 338-5790 is the number to call if you have a question for Pastor Skip about the Bible, tonight's message, or, of course, you could always ask him about his biker boots. 338-5790, 1-866-730-4921 if you're calling out of the Albuquerque area. And, of course, Skip, tonight you looked at a very important attribute of the Lord, but you entitled this message, My God is Bigger Than Your God. And of course, you were using that kind of tongue-in-cheek, but in a sense, it's completely true if we're relating that to other world religions.
You know, the bottom line truth, Brian, that you and I know and hold dear is that we can say that because there isn't any other God. There aren't many kinds of gods out there. You know, you have your belief, I have my belief. You might have a different belief than I have a belief, but there is only one true God. There aren't several. They don't compete. There's not a pantheon of deities like the Greeks believed in Babylon. There's one true God. So David could unabashedly make that comparison, as could Isaiah, as could Elijah, even in a mocking fashion. Because he knew that these very sincere Baal worshipers were cutting themselves and doing all of these gesticulations to no avail, because there is only one true God. So he could say, do it all you want, but your God can't do anything because he doesn't exist. So my God, the only true God, is bigger than your fabricated God.
That's right. And I think that's a good point to make there. There is really only one God in true existence.
Right.
However, there are small g's. There are people who elevate different things, be it a statue, be it a whatever, money, fame, power. They elevate them to the status of a god.
Certainly, and even Paul acknowledges that in Scripture. He says, there are gods many and lords many. He doesn't mean there are actual in existence different beings and entities that exercise power and have distinct personality. No, but people, as you said, elevate them and they become gods. David put it this way, your gods are made out of metal and wood, and they look like humans, but humans made them and have to carry them, and they have no power whatsoever.
That's right. A mutual friend of ours, Pastor Chuck Smith, used to say, Skip. Go ahead.
I was going to do my Chuck Smith imitation. And, Brian, there are those who actually believe in different gods and all, but we know. Go ahead.
You know, I wish everyone could see you, because you enter in Chuck. You just don't do his voice inflection. You actually sit, you enter, you cross your arms like him.
Can I do this?
You cross your fingers. It is pretty impressive, Skip.
You know.
you do full character, and I absolutely love it. But Chuck would say that a god is any person's chief or ultimate pursuit. So if someone's chief pursuit is fame or money, that would be their god, small g, whereas the Christian, of course, our chief and ultimate pursuit is the one and true living God.
And Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters. So whatever your pursuit is, whatever your master passion becomes, whatever you do worship, you have to ask yourself, am I becoming like that? Is this true? Where will this lead me eternally? All those kind of questions that need to be applied to any belief system.
That's right. So my God is bigger than your God, your title. But
are you saying your God is bigger than my God? Because our God is the same.
Our God is the same. And I wasn't calling you out. I mean, I was just making a factual statement that my God is bigger than your God is the title you gave tonight's teaching. However, the underwriting sentiment or attribute is the omnipotence or the all-powerful nature of God.
And that's even a biblical phrase, a biblical term, Revelation 19:5. I heard a great multitude and a voice of many saying, the Lord God omnipotent reigns is the anthem.
And it's a great title. Mm-hmm. But you used some other words, kind of synonyms, if you will, of omnipotence. And one was superintendence. And superintendence, of course, means one who oversees, or the management or the arrangement, or that person who has the power over a particular thing. So superintendence was another word you used in this teaching.
Right. And we could enter into more forays linguistically. God doesn't just superintend. God acts in providence. That's a really great concept. We didn't go into it. That'd be a great thing to look at, because God, what providence means is God takes ordinary circumstances of life that he has enacted, created, everybody goes through them, ordinary circumstances of life, and arranges ordinary circumstances for an extraordinary result.
Mm-hmm.
So all things work together for good to those who love God. That's
Romans
providence.
8.
And there's great books in the Bible that speak about God's part. The book of Esther is all about essentially the providence of God. He's not mentioned in the book. He's not overtly seen, but he's behind the scenes exercising control over the visible scenes.
And I love the term, and I'm glad you brought up the term providence, because in Latin it's providere, which means to see before or to see. But the idea is,
or in the lexical form, provideo.
There you go.
To see in advance. Go ahead.
That's exactly right. But it's the idea of confluence, that all these different streams, are coming off a mountain, and they're confluing into one ultimate providential
stream.
Even Ustream, I think, in the larger providential things, Ustream would be part of that. So providence is a very important attribute of God here. Mm. But obviously, in this teaching, My God is Bigger Than Your God, you cover Psalm 139, 13 through 18, and you look at three general overarching points. And one is God's work is marvelous, and you focus in on verse 14. Then you move on to God's workmanship is meticulous, and that's verses 13 through 16. And then God's wisdom is matchless, verses 17 through 18. But essentially, you're unpacking verses 13 through 18.
I camped around this mountain for a long time. I've been in Psalm 139 now for 3 or 4 weeks,
that's right.
So I'm kind of feeling like God said to Moses, you've been at this mountain long enough. So next week, we'll depart from this psalm and actually pick up that last strophe of the psalm, last paragraph section, by going to a whole different section that highlights the holiness of God a little bit better than this. But we've spent a lot of time here and unpacked it and kind of took the one scripture out and kind of isolated it first, because I believed it was a summation statement, mm-hmm. a banner statement. It was a hinge. Linguistically, it's right in the middle of between verses 13 and 15. We have the same amount of phrases before, the same amount of phrases afterwards, and they all hinge upon what David said. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knoweth right well.
Yes, and what a wonderful word, marvelous, extraordinary, causing great wonder is what marvelous looks at. And we're going to unpack that verse here in a little bit, but we're going to move to Brian, who's calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Brian. You're on Connection Q&A with Pastor Skip.
Hey, Pastor. Great message tonight.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Listen, you know, when you first started the biography of God, you mentioned that you were in an airport and you had seen the book, The Language of God.
Yes.
You know, about a week after that, I found myself traveling through Seattle on the way to Anchorage, and I saw the book. I picked it up.
Yes.
And have since read it. You mentioned it again tonight. And I would say, I've been going to Calvary Chapel for 16 years now. And I would have never thought what I'm about to say until, and I have you to thank for it, until you mentioned this book. And I've read this book now cover to cover. And I hope you don't mind me asking, have you read the whole book yet?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I don't agree with every one of his conclusions, his details. And
right.
I think there's a lot of scientists in the scientific community that do not even points them out when it comes to the intelligent design. But I read a lot of books that I don't necessarily even agree with. I like some of the things he says in it, just like I'll quote from Newsweek or Time or Life magazine. I used to when it was in print. And I don't necessarily buy into all that's in those publications.
Well, you know, I actually found it pretty fascinating. Again, I would have thought it would be heresy to even hear it coming out of my mouth. But hearing him talk about his concept of evolution, it's almost like your question, you know, can God create a rock so big that he can't lift it, right?
Yeah.
Well, is it possible that, you know, do I serve, are you a big Godder or a little Godder, right?
Yeah.
Is it possible that the big Godder used the miracle of evolution, as heretical as that sounds? I've never heard anyone explain it the way Francis Collins said. And you get to page 100, and he says, boy, if you've read this far, you know, you're either liking what I'm saying or you're really depressed. And I got to admit, I was pretty depressed.
Same. I was too.
Yeah, I read the first 100 pages on the plane from Seattle to Anchorage. And then I put the book down. It was a couple of weeks before I picked it back up. But when you get to the very end, what really blew me away is when he started talking about C.S. Lewis, who's another person that I really like. I've also heard people say that Dinesh D'Souza in his book, What's So Great About Christianity.
Yep.
I haven't read that one.
I read it. It's a great book.
I understand he has some kind of similar feel. So I'm just, I was curious, would you consider it heretical to have his view? Are you open to, you know, to people that have never had that view to suddenly saying, you know, boy, there might be some meat to what he's talking about? To do it, you have to almost grasp the concept of Genesis, the beginning of it being a poem, which as he was talking about that, I was thinking of Rob Bell in his video, Everything is Spiritual. I don't know if you've seen that.
I have seen it.
Yeah, and that's kind of the same thing where the whole intro to Genesis is poetic. So I'll hang up here if you don't mind. I'll tune in on the radio and just interested in what you had to say. But you're a great pastor, man, and we love you.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for the question. And, you know, Brian Nixon now. There's two Brians. There's a Brian on the radio and there's Brian Nixon.
That's right.
This is a great and insightful question.
It truly is.
And I would say it took him some guts to be that honest about that question and that viewpoint. It's not a new viewpoint. It's quite an old viewpoint. It's called theistic evolution. Mm-hmm. It's been around a long time. It's been articulated in a number of different ways. And a lot of people find it the only tenable position to take in the scientific community because of where they sit, because of who they associate with. And I'm not – listen, this guy Collins has done a great work. I don't agree with him. I would – love, and I've talked to scientists and biochemists about this book, and they start immediately saying, boy, I want to meet him. I want to talk to him because he has not discovered like the paleontological sciences. One guy who wrote several books that I have in my library, mm-hmm. I was on the phone with him. And what I would recommend to Brian or caller, and even Dr. Collins, who wrote the book, is some of the writings of Michael Behe, mm-hmm. whose whole premise of irreducible complexity, you know, in a couple of his books, Science and Evidence for the Design of the Universe, Darwin's Black Box. Please get that book. And so, listen, the guy asked the question, Brian asked, can a person hold to that view and is not be considered heretical? We're not saved by our view of evolution. We're not saved by our view of speaking in tongues. We're saved by faith in Christ alone. We can't spiritualize that. We can't mess with that. I think that I know where he's coming from. I understand how the author of the book weaves the argument of design into theistic evolution. I do not see Genesis as a poetical description. That's part of the basis of theistic evolution. And he will find that there's a lot of people in the scientific community who are believers who do not hold the view of Collins, but they hold the view of special creation mm-hmm. and intelligent design.
Yeah. Great question, Brian. We do appreciate it.
And Brian Nixon, you should weigh in on this because of your background as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, just for the record, we might as well just espouse the four major views of
Let's
beginning.
Let's get them out.
Obviously, theistic evolution, which believes that God worked through the process of evolution to create the world. I would say, and this might be overstepping it, Skip, but I would say most Bible-believing Christians do not believe theistic evolution. Obviously, there are some out there, but I would say generally that view is a view that is not held.
I think that's accurate.
By majority of Bible-believing Christians. The second view is what we would call the gap theory. Now, the gap theory would state that we do live in an ancient universe, up to what most scientists would say, 14 to 16 billion years. But where they interpret Genesis, as you know, there's a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. So the gap theorists would still believe in an ancient universe, but they believe there was a separation between when God first created everything, then Satan and the angels fell, and then there was, in a sense, a recreation-type period whereby the geological and other phenomena here on Earth took place. So, gap theorists, still old. The third view is what we'd call the day-age theory. And what's interesting here, Skip, as you know, there sometimes is a very difficult way to determine between the theistic evolution and the day-age theory. But there is a difference. And I'm just going to use his name, not bashing him one way or another, but a gentleman by the name of Hugh Ross, who is a day-age theorist. He would not believe in theistic evolution, but he does believe in an ancient Earth that every day corresponds to a period of time. So, in a sense,
and a lot in the scientific community loved Ross's work because of what they said were the obvious evidences of an old Earth, not a young Earth.
That's right.
A lot flocked to that.
But in Hugh Ross's view, as you know, he still does have almost a poetical view of Genesis chapter 1. He doesn't take what we would consider a literalist or take Genesis 1 in its literal form. He kind of broad brushes it, looks at it, defines it in different ways. But the point is that he is a person that holds a day-age theory, very popular, very well-known throughout the Christian church. And then, of course, the fourth view is a literal 24-hour period of time that God actually created the heavens and the earth in 6 days and then rested on the seventh. And we could, which we won't, but we could really unpack the word yom, look at the biblical ramifications and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is this. Most biblicists, most people who look and deal with Genesis 1:1 would interpret the word yom, which is the Hebrew word there for day, as a literal 24-hour period of time.
And we can get past the definition. You could, like you said, unpack the definition, but if you went on to look at the description and you didn't know Hebrew or yom, you just simply see the description. It tells you what yom is, what day is, and evening and morning were the first day. So when it says there's a sun and a moon and the lights for night, day, and evening and morning were the first day, that tells you that's a 24-hour cycle.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And then if you say it's poetic, at what point does the language become literal?
Mm-hmm.
If that's poetic, well, maybe it's a poetic sun. Maybe it's a poetic moon. Maybe it's a poetic evening and a poetic morning, and these are poetic people, and these are poetic plants. At what point in the narrative does it cease to become poetic, if ever? And then if that is poetic, is the New Testament as poetic?
Or even the rest of the book of Genesis. Does Moses, the undisputed author of Genesis, does he wax poetic chapter 1, but then in verse 2 does he get literal? Or does he get literal in verse chapter 3?
This is the issue I take with the amillennial viewpoint of eschatology, is that if it's all figurative, then at what point is it literal? And how can you say that's literal but that's figurative? What gives you the right to become the interpretive of benchmark of saying, well, I know it says that, but it didn't mean that.
Right.
Now, sometimes there's obvious metaphor, an obvious simile, an obvious figurative language. You can see whether they're metonyms or whatever. You can see pretty plainly and obviously. And where you can't, then you state that you can't. And you, for sake of spiritual and intellectual honesty, you put out different viewpoints and you take your pick.
Yeah, and when you look at Genesis, and specifically Genesis chapter 1 and 2, there is no indication that Moses meant anything else other than a literalist approach, meaning he all of a sudden didn't switch to a poetic voice, let's say in chapter 15 or chapter 16. His intent from the beginning was to record what he received.
Well, there it is, folks. You heard it here first. Brian Nixon.
There it was. 338-5790 is the number to call. 338-5790 is the number to call if you have a question for Pastor Skip, or 1-866-730-4921. That's if you're out of the Albuquerque area.
We have a question. Can you see it on your screen from the KNKT studio? I can only infer that this is our illustrious producer.
Yeah, I see
Steve
this
Ryman,
studio.
And he's posing a question that's right here on our screen. I expect to be answered on the air.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, you know, we might as well go ahead and say this question, though, you know, we may be treading on, you know, some really thin water, but it says this. I, that is Steve Ryman, our producer, am praying. Now, praying as in, you know, prostrating himself before the Lord.
Well, that's not the only form the Bible indicates for prayer.
Okay.
You could pray silently. It's not necessarily proskuneo. Okay. Or go ahead.
Good, good. I'm glad you clarified that. For the Eagles to win this week. And then here's his question. Is this wrong? Skip, is praying for the Eagles wrong?
I saw an eagle one time that was injured that I prayed for. No, you know, he means the team, right?
That's right.
Is that a football team, Brian?
They're from Philadelphia.
See, you know, to Steve, I think I just asked a blasphemous question. I don't even know who they are.
They are apparently – see, I have a little advantage. I am not a football fan, and that is sacrilegious, I know. But
not at all, Brian.
Well, I'm not. But Steve informed me that the Eagles play another team tomorrow, and the winner of that team goes on to play for some other thing next week. I think it's like the AFC Division Championships. And then the winner of that goes to the Super Bowl.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's why he's asking this particular question, because it weighs heavy on his heart. So is it wrong to
– It's never wrong to pray. I think you can – Spurgeon said this way, I'm not afraid to pour anything into the ears of my God in heaven. So I think since he is concerned – I don't think he cares who wins the game, but I think he's concerned for his children. But it doesn't mean he's going to be swayed one way or the other. I think a game is – it's our natural tendency, though, when we see something, whether it's on television, it's been pre-recorded, or a game, oh, Lord, help them. And so that's a good, I guess, proclivity to have. But I don't think God cares.
There you have it, Steve. We love you anyway. Well, Skip, your answer here, our discussion on theistic evolution, really sparked something. We have some more callers. So before we get into your message this evening, let's deal with some more of these. Let's go to Alan, calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Alan. You're on Connection Q&A with Pastor Skip.
Thank you, sir. Pastor, not chaplain, Heitzig, it's good to talk to you, sir.
Good to talk to you.
Sir, I wanted to comment something on Brian's call earlier, which is a very thoughtful call. One of the things that might help Brian consider that in with the evolutionary concept, does it not mean that there are so many species that were almost an error that they had to that they disappeared and became extinct, but since God created things that all things were created good, or where he said when everything was good, that for being a theistic evolutionist, you have to consider that God had made some mistakes that had to go extinct, create for other species.
And yeah. Yeah, I think it's a good point. And, you know, we were discussing a book that we both read and we both felt uncomfortable with, though we both liked. I liked the book. I don't agree with the whole thing. I quoted part of it tonight. I still found it fascinating that the head of the Human Genome Project believed that God created and designed everything. So I don't know anything much beyond that. He does follow the writings of C.S. Lewis and others through the book. But you break up a good point, and that is if evolution was tenable, there would be an abundance of transitional forms of all species and all phyla that we just do not see now. That was the one thing Charles Darwin was aware of when he wrote Origin of the Species, is that the glaring holes in the paleontological record that he could not account for, thought would eventually be resolved, which they weren't resolved. They just got bigger and bigger. And, you know, the record does, the fossil record does show a sudden appearance of creatures, but not transitional forms. And if it were a tenable theory, and beyond a theory, what some think a fact, you would see an abundance of transitional forms that we just do not see. So the fossil record is great evidence against the concept of what we would call macroevolution. I do want to say that most scientific Christians mm-hmm. do believe, Brian, in microevolution.
That's correct.
That's you can see that.
Variations within species.
But a lot of Christians, when they hear that, they get all upset. They don't understand what that is. It's just simple. Like as you said, adaptations and variations, but they're not huge. You don't see a dog cat.
Right.
You don't see an eye developing that suddenly opens. You do not see the hard evidence of transitional form. You see transmutation, but not not the forms themselves.
Yeah, and Alan brought up a great point, Skip, about the what we would call missing links or the transitional fossils. The fossil record does not support, obviously, evolution. But when you really go back, let's go back 150 years to Darwin's time.
I wasn't there.
You weren't there, and I just wanted to point that out right now. But if we were there, just think of how, and I use this respectfully, but just think of how naive and how, in a sense, primitive, scientifically speaking, Darwin and his compatriots were. And let me just give you a clear-cut example. You're talking about DNA. You talked in great deal about that in your message tonight. But Darwin and his compatriots and his men, first of all, had no idea what a cell is in what we would know as the modern scientific realm. So the whole idea of a cellular or a DNA or whatever goes on within the cell, be it the mitochondria, be it the, you know, all the other various attributes of that cell, they were completely clueless. So in a sense, here's my point. Darwin was trying to construct a theory without having the total picture. He was, in a sense, trying to fix the plumbing, and he didn't even have the wrench. He essentially was giving a forecast or projection of plausibly how something happened, but he didn't have all the right words. It would almost be akin to me saying, hey, Skip, I want you to go ahead and write me a book this week, and I'm going to give you the first seven letters of the alphabet. And you're going to go home, and you're going to start trying to construct words out of these seven. And pretty soon you're going to go, well, I can't. I don't have enough tools. I don't have enough information in order to do that. Well, the past 150 years, we have gathered a tremendous amount of information about the DNA, about how the cell works.
That's a great analogy, Brian Nixon.
And we're still learning more. But the point is, Darwin didn't have all the information he needed to even make an educated guess about evolution. So what we get is the fossil record is, of course, one indicator that he was wrong, but also the cell itself and the complexity, what you had mentioned, the irreducible complexity, is another.
Yeah, I heard a great scientist who spoke here and talked about what goes on in a cell, and he was trying to describe it to us, the audience. And he said, what goes on in a cell is like bigger than what goes on in Tokyo or New York City.
That's right.
And the exchange of electrical impulses and chemicals and the orders that are given and received, it's staggering.
It truly is staggering. And, you know, back even after Darwin had died, they would use terms such as a simple cell. Well, there's no such thing as a simple cell. You had mentioned it tonight in your teaching. You know, the bases and the phosphate and the sugar. You have guanine, you have cystosine, you have thymine and adenine. And these are the four bases, and they have to match up perfectly with other bases and phosphates. But not only to make things more interesting and complex, these bases and phosphates and everything, some are left-handed, meaning they have to fit in a particular mode, like a particular glove would have to fit on left hand. Others are more right-handed. So not only do they have to match up with their particular bases, let's say adenine with thymine, but they have to do it in such a way that one is recognizes and fits in with the left-handed version and the other right-handed. The point is, it's incredibly complex, and it just doesn't happen through evolution. There isn't enough time, which leads us to a third reason why evolution is wrong. We have the fossil record, we have irreducible complexity, but 16 billion years is not enough time.
Not enough time. And a great study at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia studied the idea of time and randomness. And their conclusion, it's a great study to look at, is that given the time that is now being said for the universe being in existence, there was not enough time for the processes that they say are randomness to create or make or account for what is now visible and contingent.
That's right. I mean, and some of the newest studies in probability, of course, we're talking about probability, is that it's not even enough time to actually evolve one cell. Because as you pointed out in your study tonight, 4,000 volumes of printed material it would take to uncode or discuss one cell. And then you had talked about the 49 or the trillions of cells we have, and it could fill the Grand Canyon in multiple times.
78 times.
Just think of how long, evolutionary-wise, it would take to do that for the multiplicity of cells out there. Mm. It's just probability. It's not going to happen. So, Alan, that was a long answer to your question, but not only the fossil record is a great tool to use against evolutionists, but also probability that 16 million years is not enough time, and also the complexity, irreducible complexity of the cell, of the eyeball, of the human body. The more we get to know, the more information we get, the more we are in awe of creation. But we do appreciate your call. God bless you this day, Alan. Thanks for listening to the program. Let's go now to Anthony calling from Albuquerque. Hi, Anthony. You're on Connection Q&A with Pastor Skip.
Hi, Skip and Brian. First of all, did you all see the moon tonight?
Oh, beautiful.
Yes.
Really awesome. And my question has to do about light. Skip, what is the Hebrew word for light? And is the light that God created more than just the opposite of darkness? Is it symbolic in different ways? And how can we help to share this knowledge with others? Would you like me to stay on the line or listen to you?
Whatever's easiest for you, Anthony.
I'll just stay on the phone.
Okay.
Anthony, I'm looking at the Hebrew word right now in Genesis 1:3, where God said, let there be light. And it's translated in English, light. And it's the Hebrew word or, and with an aleph and a pronunciation vowel sound, and then the resh for or. And so let there be or light. And that word is used literally here, but it also is used figuratively and contextually. You can see the difference. If I say, I can do that in English, I can say, boy, it's very light out here. Or I can say, I feel lightheaded. It doesn't mean that I have a bright light in my head. Or I'm picking up my computer. That's pretty light. It doesn't mean it's bright. It just simply means it's the opposite of heavy. So one word can have a multiplicity of meanings or several shades of meaning, but the context will bear that out. In this case, it's literal. There's a literal God who literally made a literal heaven and literal earth, and we're living on the literal earth, and God said, let there be light. So in this case, this word translated or is the word for light in Hebrew, the literal term of light, or fire. Sometimes it's translated fire. Interestingly, since we're on this, what the words mean, Ur of the Chaldees, the idea of Ur was fire, was light. And they believed that they were bringing enlightenment, that it was the light of God. They had a lot of connotations from mm-hmm. ancient language. But to answer your question, it's speaking of the literal light that we see still today. Light travels at 186,000 miles per second. It's real energy. And there was an abundance of it when God said, let there be some.
And then, of course, the Greek, I believe, is phos, or P-H-O-S, which we would get
phosphorus.
Yeah. So
and phosphorescent.
Phosphorescent.
I mean, fluorescent.
Yep. And obviously, the Greek, I believe, Skip, you could correct me on this, for darkness is skotia. And they obviously are played against each other in the New Testament, specifically light versus darkness on a spiritual level.
Sure. And any language has sometimes the same word that are used in a literal form and that are used in a figurative form. And the context will bring it out. Is it poetry? Mm-hmm. Is it narrative? Who's saying it? When are they speaking? Why are they speaking? What other words are around it? What are the relationship of the words? What's the history in the background? All of that is part of the rule of hermeneutics. And we read the Bible very plainly and literally. And there's no mystical meaning of the Bible. It's pretty straightforward.
Right. Did that answer your question, Anthony?
Yes. And, you know, just one other thing. I guess, you know, in the days of creation, Earth was on the third day. And the fourth day, then the sun, the moon, and the stars. And the light that we get from those, is that kind of the same light that was created on day one?
Yeah, there's an interesting debate about the days of creation, the chronology of it, Genesis 1 versus Genesis 2, and we just don't have enough time. We barely cracked our study tonight to get into that. I would recommend some of the writings of Morris and Gish that from a scientific level, at their time, Brian, I think did a great job with it.
Yeah.
The Genesis record?
That's right. That's what I would recommend as well, Anthony, that you would pick up the commentary called The Genesis Record by Dr. Henry Morris. It is a commentary on the book of Genesis, but it's taken from a distinctly scientific view. He was, of course, an engineer scientist by trade, as well as a wonderful Christian man. So there is a tremendous book for you, Anthony. We do appreciate your call. Skip, boy, we have not even cracked open barely your study, but...
Well, let's go for it. Go to it.
Yeah, let's get to that. But we're also getting a lot of discussion on our Ustream word as well. But let's...
And somebody loves Genesis.
That's right.
That's their first words. Ustreamers 87300. I love Genesis.
That's
well, so
right.
So do I.
Yes, so do I. But before we go to our Ustreamer questions, let's go ahead and get into point one. God's work, and we've been discussing, albeit in an offbeat way, God's work is marvelous. And of course, marvelous does mean extraordinary or causing a great wonder, extremely good. What did you mean specifically by God's work is marvelous?
It's just something that David noted. It was David's way of, you know, David, look in a psalm, to break it down linguistically, he's taking different aspects of God. It's like God is this brilliant diamond, and I turn it one way, and wow, look at that. God knows everything. He turns it another way. Look at that. God is everywhere. I can't get away from him. Turns it again, talks about yet another characteristic of his nature, and that is what he can do. And it's not about that his presence is wonderful or marvelous. It's not that his knowledge is wonderful. He's already covered that. Marvelous is your work. That's the theme of that section, is his work, his ability to output and work with and energize and use energy to do work. So marvelous is your work. And David saw a lot of it. And everything he saw, he said, was pretty marvelous.
Yeah, and as you pointed out at the beginning of the program, that was David's hinge thought. I mean, really, that is what he builds all, not only this section, but kind of the whole scripture.
It is, because verse passage 13 through 16 is, I was fearfully, wonderfully made, wrought in the lower parts of the earth. All of that poetic, great language is about human gestation and the development of an embryo and a fetus and a womb. But the hinge thought is, marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. And that's sandwiched in between all of that description of what goes on in the development of a child.
Yeah, and in that light, you do bring up as your point too, God's workmanship is meticulous. And I like that word meticulous, because it just means God has given great attention to. He's given really the details of this. And you point out in your message that it's interesting that God uses the human body to really unravel the type of detail he has given towards his creation.
Yeah, and we use the word creation. It's not in the psalm, but he says, I'm fearfully, wonderfully made. You did this, you did that. So he ascribes it to God. We can safely call that creation. So of all of the examples, though, that David used to point to God's magnificent, marvelous work in creation, he chose the human body.
Mm-hmm.
He chose a child in a womb, something that happens every day, but it's still fascinating and marvelous. He could have pointed to the heavens like he did in other psalms. He didn't do that. He was aware of it. He saw it. They were part of the subject matter of other writings of his and scriptural writers. But to David, the quintessential crowning creation is humanity.
Mm-hmm.
We're made in the imago Dei, the image of God.
That's right. And it's beautiful. And it's interesting, that word form there you brought out in your teaching tonight, it really does mean create or to bring forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so God is talking about this creative, this detailed precision of creating the human body in his image. Obviously, it has a spiritual nature to it as well. But you even pointed out that the word covered means knitted or grown together. So
skillfully wrought is my translation. In the lowest parts of the earth, it means embroidered.
Yeah.
I was embroidered or knit by God.
So what's fascinating is, and you draw this out, is that God or David is really describing the human body in poetical terms, the veins that are knit together. It's amazing.
And let me caution those who are listeners not to see this as some dumb shepherd who can't articulate, doesn't know very much about science. And so he's, you know, in a simplistic manner describing something very scientific in detail. That's stupid. It's a very poetic description of what really happens, any more than that person who might be thinking that tomorrow will say, hey, look at the sunrise. Sun didn't rise.
That's right.
We rotate around the sun, but it's just a common colloquialism to describe it in our own modern poetry as sunrise, sunset.
Yes.
Even though that's not exactly what happens, it's okay to do that. It's perfectly understood. And so when David uses this language of I was embroidered or knit, wrought, you know, that's a poetic description of what happens. In the placenta, there is a network of veins and arteries that are developed. In fact, the blood supply is quite amazing as it's developed to let a lot of blood through in a very short period of time to circulate through that very quickly growing set of cells that is a human being.
It truly, I mean, it is mind-boggling. I mean, to think what happens from the moment of conception, that first 9 months,
and now there's really cool movies you can see that go in with these little cameras and show it all. It's so cool.
Unbelievable. And truly, we could say it's meticulous. And it is marvelous. And it is God's workmanship. As you were teaching, you didn't mention this in your teaching, but it drew my, when you use the word workmanship, it drew my attention to Paul in the New Testament, where he says we are God's
poem.
We're his poem. Poema. We're God's workmanship. It's a beautiful parallel.
I like the term work of art. We're God's work of art. And I like that because I'm in process. I'm in progress. I ain't done yet.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I look at the canvas and I go, gosh, this looks really botched, doesn't it? I mean, look, there's that blob of paint there. And what's this going to be? But the artist sees the end product in his mind. And that's what I love about sanctification, is that God sees it all happening so much so that he can declare in advance that he's chosen me and he's justified me and he's glorified past tense, even though it's going to be a future reality.
And that's where God's superintendence and providence comes in.
Yep.
It truly is a beautiful thing in the workmanship of his creation.
Well.
So you did God's work is marvelous, God's workmanship is meticulous, and then you concluded with God's wisdom is matchless.
He considers God's thoughts. It's just sort of like he pauses. He's writing the poem down. I can sort of picture it, though I can't be sure. And as he's pondering all this, he realizes this fabulous, all-present, all-powerful, all-knowing God thinks about me. Thinks about me so much that if I were to number them, they'd be more in number than the sand. How precious are your thoughts? You know, there's a couple ways to look at that. That when I think about how much God thinks about me, I consider that precious knowledge to myself. Or the thought is, the thoughts that God thinks toward me are precious thoughts.
Beautiful. And I just even like the word matchless, you know, unparalleled. It's just a beautiful word to use in this relationship.
Because, Brian, you know what? You know how you feel when somebody says, hey, Brian, good to see you. I've been thinking about you. You've been on my mind lately. Well, now translate that into what we just hear about God. God's been thinking about you before the creation of the world.
Yeah. And I like that you pointed out in relationship to this, where David in this psalm uses the word book. And obviously it's a poetical nuance, but isn't it an interesting element? Because when you think of a book, you think of a book having a beginning, a middle, an ending. There's plots, there's subplots, there's different characters. It is a good parallel to a life. So ultimately, with David using this term, God knows us from the beginning to the end, the ups and downs, the characters.
Cover to cover.
Cover to cover.
Right.
That's the easiest way to say it.
From capital to period.
That's right. From capital to period. So that is a truly beautiful thought, but a very comforting thought.
And where my mind took it because of my background is the way it's written. You know, he's speaking about predetermination, really. That's a whole other subject in and of itself. But that God knew in advance what my life would be, what the development course would take, as if he programmed it. That's the idea of he wrote it. He's the author of it, and it does have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So I just thought of there's a language, as Collins calls it, a language of God written in the cellular structure of humanity, you know, with the DNA.
That's right. That is exactly right. I love that. And I like what you said in tonight's study, Skip. when you begin to ponder these truths of God's love for us, knowing us from cover to cover, that he's working in us, it draws out two elements. One is it elevates our purpose in life. We see that there is a greater purpose. In a sense, it gives us hope as human beings. We have a reason to live.
Right. Because either you're a fortuitous occurrence of accidental circumstance, or I'm a special creation, therefore I have purpose.
That's right.
Which way do you want to live?
Yeah, true. True. And then secondly, it increases our faith. And as believers, that's what we want. We want our faith increase. We want to grow more and more into the image of Christ.
Right. And then it makes, if those two are true, if I can trust him because there is purpose for my life, then it puts me on a pursuit, Brian. Mm. I want to know what God's will is. And I thought, and I quoted it tonight in Colossians 1, the prayer of Paul is that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will. Hmm. What greater knowledge can you have than knowing what God's purpose, plan, will is for your life? Hmm. That's a great way to live.
Truly is. So God's omnipotence, his omnipotence.
There you go. You could put it that way
Well. That's right. God is all powerful. His work is marvelous. His workmanship is meticulous. His wisdom is matchless. Now, when we're talking about God's power, though, we do have to just briefly, and you do mention it in your teaching tonight, there are some pundits out there who like to throw philosophical quandrums, or they'll even throw out syllogisms trying to trip up the Christian. And you threw one like this tonight. Can God make a rock big enough that he can't lift? Other ones are...
It's a self-canceling question.
That's right. Can God make a triangle square? Can God make the color yellow green?
Right. I've heard all of that. It's just... It's palaver.
It is palaver.
It's palaver. It's nonsense. It's a self-canceling question. God can do... Here's the definition of omnipotence. God can do anything he pleases that is in harmony with his nature and character. And the Bible explicitly says there's a few things God can't do because of that definition. He cannot lie.
That's right.
He is always faithful. He cannot hang and tolerate and approve of evil and can't let it go unchecked. Has to deal with it. It's part of his very nature.
And he can't be unfaithful as well.
So the idea of, well, why can't there be a God who just winks at everybody and tells? He can't do that. That's against his nature. It's not who he is.
That's right, because he is truly holy.
And therefore he must judge sin.
That's right. But sadly, in today's theological world, if you will, there are a whole spectrum of individuals who do deny God's all-powerful nature. And we would know that as those who are in process or open theology, and they would argue that God is not all-powerful. He doesn't know the end from the beginning. And there are theologians out there who have books saying how God is not all-powerful. If God was truly all-powerful, he would stop evil and so on and so forth is what their argument is.
Right.
But that's clearly not what the Bible teaches. The Bible clearly teaches that God is all-powerful.
Yeah, it's better to just read what it says. God meant what he said, and he said what he meant.
That's exactly right.
Right, John?
Absolutely.
That's right. Skip, we only have a few minutes left, but we've got to address some of these
Ustreamers.
They are just going to town. Ustreamer.
So, I want to know this. Can the Ustreamers see John Privet? He's the guy in the studio with the silver hair, comb back, got the Elvis do going on.
The ducktail.
What is it called?
The ducktail.
The ducktail. He's got the Nashville ducktail. I tell you what, it's pretty nice.
and they'll answer us if they could see it. But here's their question.
Yeah.
Ustreamer 87300 says, I love Genesis. One crazy question. Eve was created from Adam's rib. Is there a way that God took the genetic information from Adam's rib to create Eve? So is it possible that God cloned Eve?
It says clonated.
Yeah, but they meant cloned.
Okay. I don't think God clonated anybody. Interesting question. You know, this is all through the lens of modern technology. See, we're prisoners of our own knowledge, because all we know, we've discovered cloning, so we go, wow, maybe you cloned him. Or we discovered DNA. Well, maybe the answer to that is, I don't know. I wasn't there. The Bible doesn't give us that information, Brian. So, and the idea of the rib is actually a portion or a side of Adam. It's translated rib. It can mean rib, but but it just simply means the side of Adam.
And and Ustreamer 8730, I did you answered Skip's question. You said yes, I could see John, but I can't see his boots. So John now has his boots up
but
on the table.
They're not like the coolest boots. They're like work boots. They're kind of cool. They'd be like mountain boots, hiking boots.
They're logger boots. So Ustreamer 8730, yes, now you see John's boots. But here, let me say why it was not cloning. Because cloning is an exact replication, duplication of a particular DNA strand or a particular cellular structure. Adam and Eve cannot be two complete identical things. One's a male, one's a female. So the Lord there did something other than cloning. He did not make one thing out of the other. We didn't get two Adams.
And the idea for made is the same idea as for Adam. God made ex nihilo, special creation, out of nothing.
That's exactly
right. He used a rib, but it's not because he had to. He just made it as in reference to and in relation to they were related to each other because they were from the human strand.
Yeah, and of course, I think, you know, we could look at this on many levels. One, you could see the scientific level. God could do anything he wants to do.
Go ahead, keep talking. I'm going to put my boots up so people can see them.
Yeah, because they are having a heyday on this now, just so you know. You know me. Ha, ha, ha. Lots of laughing out loud. I love them. So they're liking your guys' boot exhibit that you're giving. But the idea is the rib also could mean the tender part of the heart, you know, the spiritual nature. So I think God.
So you see that as a poetic, not
no,
literal?
No, I believe it's literal, but it has poetic ramifications as well.
What does that mean exactly? Poetic ramifications.
That means that it has shadows of meaning where the Lord actually created from a rib, but it also could have a deeper meaning.
Interesting.
Anagogical. I'm just all of a sudden I went anagogical in our interpretation. I'm very Eurasian right now. I don't know what happened to me. I used to be much more
pedagogical.
Yeah, pedagogical is the study of how we learn and such through paideia of students. But anyway, Skip, it's
Brian.
Been one fun program.
John, you're here in the studio. Your people on Ustream, they can see you. They saw your. What is it called?
Your boots.
Your ducktail, the whole Elvis thing going on, Silver Elvis, and they saw your boots, and it's just great to be here. What do you want to say to sum up everything?
I would say that there is only one true God, and it's great to be serving him.
See, that's it. It's great to be serving him. When you know him, then you know, you want to serve him, and it's great. And people who do know him and love him, they want to serve him. And they find purpose and meaning in life. It's the essence of what we're studying tonight. So, John, thanks.
Thank you, John, and a great study in God's powerful nature. A look at his work, his workmanship, and his wisdom. Of course, we had a lot of discussion about Genesis 1, chapter 1, but it was a very fruitful discussion. Skip, thanks so much. Pleasure having you on. John, next time we'll try to set up a microphone so you could chime in on some of these.
To it.
All right. We do want to thank Steve and Sophia for their wonderful
Steve,
engineering.
Steve, who is now praying for the Eagles to win.
The Eagles to win. And we thank all of our Ustreamers. We thank our callers, Brian, Alan, Anthony, and the other ones. We do appreciate each of you. May the Lord richly
and
bless
Brian,
you this week.
Thank you.
Well, Skip, it's my pleasure. God bless each of you.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Connection Q&A with Pastor Skip Heitzig. We'll be here live next Saturday night at 8 p.m., right after the evening service from Calvary of Albuquerque. You can still email your questions to knkt@calvaryabq.org or call them in live next time on Connection Q&A.